you have any questions for Politics and Science, you can direct them by email to politicsandscience@madriver.com. That's politicsandscience@madriver.com. Politics and Science can be heard weekly on WMRW LP Warren 95.1 FM, airing on Mondays at 5 p.m. And in the Bellows Falls area, can be heard on Wool LP Bellows Falls at 101.1 FM, airing from 3 to 4 p.m. on Sundays and from 9 to 10 a.m. on Mondays. Politics and Science presents the viewpoints of its participants and does not necessarily reflect the viewpoints of any other person or organization. It's time for Politics and Science with your host, John Barkhausen. I'm happy to say that my guest today is Dr. Rosalie Bertell, who's a Grey Nun of the Sacred Heart and also received her PhD degree in biometrics with minors in biology and biochemistry from the Catholic University of America in 1966. Since that time, she has worked as a biometrician and environmental epidemiologist. By choice, Dr. Bertell works for the victims or potential victims of industrial, technological, and military pollution, with a particular emphasis on assisting the struggles of third world and indigenous people to preserve the human right to life and health. The major issues are the dangers associated with economic globalization, war, and the proliferation of chemical and radioactive pollutants as a result of preparation for war and the toxic products and processes developed from weapons research and production. This is a long, impressive biography, but I think it's important to read it because it really gives you an idea of how much work she has done throughout her life. The International Institute of Concern for Public Health, the IICPH, which is how I was able to contact her, and which she founded, opened its doors in 1984 in Toronto, Canada, and continues to serve as an institutional support for her work. She is also a founding member of the International Commission of Health Professionals and the International Association of Humanitarian Medicine. So, Dr. Rosalie Bertell, welcome to Politics and Science.
Thank you very much.
Well, I've been focusing primarily on radiation and basically its effect on life in general on Earth, but I think we're mostly talking about ionizing radiation, so I would like to go into that. But first, I'd like to find out a little more about your life. Did you take the vows of the Grey Nuns? When did you do that, and how did that relate to your scientific career?
Well, I've been a Grey Nun for more than 50 years. And I was, prior to that, I spent 6 years in a Carmelite monastery, which is a contemplative community. So I have, most of my life I've been a sister, and it doesn't have any problem for science, because we're looking for truth, and I don't find them in conflict. It's not at all foreign to our work. We do hospital work, social work, and education.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty much all of those.
Yeah. And you started by studying biology and biochemistry, or was it always statistics and biometrics?
I have been a math major right through to the doctorate, but when I got to the doctoral studies, the National Institute of Health was providing scholarships to mathematicians who would begin to apply higher math to biology and biomedical problems. So I got into one of those programs, and they gave me a scholarship for 3 years to get the doctorate. So I did pretty heavy foundational work in the biochemistry and biology. In fact, I got the equivalent of a master's degree in biology, because prior to that, mathematicians were put in physics and chemistry. So I needed to fill in the background and then take graduate courses. So anyway, it was very interesting to me, because I found the life sciences much more complex and challenging than physics.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine it's a lot less understood in a way, life sciences.
Well, I think they failed to mathematicize it because it was so hard. You know, we have the, I guess, mental image that physics is hard because it's got a lot of math in it.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, physics was the easiest one to mathematicize. So the life sciences are much more variable and hard to handle mathematically. So I did 10 years of research at Roswell Park Cancer Hospital in Buffalo, which is how I got interested in the environmental causes or factors which increase your chance of getting cancer. That's how I got into all the environmental problems, and in particular the diagnostic medical x-rays. I spent about 5 years just studying the effect on large populations of diagnostic medical x-ray, which is how I got into the low-dose radiation problems.
I see. So fill us in a little bit on how you came to be able to do that study. I know it's not easy to get grants. And was that right after you got your degrees, or were you working at another institution?
I worked with a team of about 28 people. So it was a very big study. It was based in Maryland, New York State, and Minnesota. And the collecting institutes were Johns Hopkins, Roswell Park, and the University of Minnesota. So we had some very good data. They were they actually went to the homes of leukemia patients as soon as they were diagnosed and interviewed the people. So it's not a death certificate study. And we had a lot of data on about 50 different variables. So you can imagine it was a huge job to sort through the variables and try to find out what were the most important factors that were increasing the rate of leukemia in the population.
And who funded the study, Dr. Bertel?
National Cancer Institute.
I see.
They funded us for 20 years. And when we published the radiation data, they took our funding away, which was quite bizarre because there was a lot more in there.
Hmm.
They moved it all in-house, so it went to government agencies to handle. Radiation's a hot topic. And what we found was contrary to what they were saying about radiation protection. They pretty much disregard things like x-rays.
So this study went on for 20 years, you said? And at the end of it, you started publishing the results of it? Or were the results coming out as you were, as the study sort of matured?
Well, it took 3 years to collect the data, and then you had time to put it all in computer, took huge computer backup, and then the analysis started, and that was probably 10 years of analysis, so it was mm-hmm. coming out during those 10 years.
I see.
But we finally zeroed in on the radiation data as the most important data in the study.
And what years were these studies
They
done?
Started in around 1960.
Okay. As the results started being published by your group, the National Cancer Institute basically shut you down?
You know, they're the funders. You publish in peer-reviewed journals. So mine's like in the Journal of Oncology. But it's they're in different journals. There's many, many publications. Because not only Roswell was publishing, but also Johns Hopkins and the University of Minnesota.
And there was a general consensus among the epidemiologists doing the study that radiation was a major cause. Well, maybe you can tell us in some detail what kinds of radiation and what the significance of the study was.
Well, I should say many people kind of gave up on the radiation data because it wasn't consistent. And I went at it a little differently, which opened up the whole field. Normally, when you do an epidemiological study, you have to control for the age of people because different illnesses show up at different ages. So I had noticed that the increase of leukemia in the population just by age increase was similar in shape to the increase with medical x-ray. And we had very fine data. We had actually individual data on what x-rays people had, and that was all confirmed in the hospital or doctor's office, so that it was very good data. And so I started to ask a different question. Instead of how much radiation would cause how much cancer, I said how much radiation would be equivalent to 1 year of aging for increasing your cancer risk.
Hmm.
And so, of course, I got a different answer, which disturbed the radiation protection group, because they never asked that question, so they never got that answer.
Yeah.
And what I found was it depended on the dose to the bone marrow. Now, leukemia is a blood disease, and so the bone marrow is where you produce your blood cells. So that's, you know, that's reasonable. And if the dose to bone marrow is the same as the radiation background dose for the year, you raise your risk of leukemia by the same amount. So they were pretty much in sync, right up to old age. And so that was quite surprising. And what I did after that is I used it as a factor for control. So I not only controlled for age, but I controlled for radiation exposure. And much of the rest of the data fell into place. And I think for the first time, there was similar findings for men and women. Before that, it had been quite different for the two sexes. And so we started to look at why was that true, and we found out that males got a lot more radiation exposure during the sports years. And then women had more dental x-rays during their early pregnancies, and then in midlife they had more during menopause. So there was a social difference in the exposures to radiation that all smoothed out when you looked at the data properly.
Hmm.
So it's, you know, it's kind of complex to do on the over the air, but papers are all available in published journals.
And you've published some books. Is any of that work covered in the books you've written?
I think probably the best paper, 1998, they had a 100-year of Rankin. It was his 100th birthday,
mm-hmm.
So they had a radiation protection conference in Berlin, and so I put it all in one place there. If you if anyone wants to get the proceedings of that conference, called 100 Years After Rankin.
Okay.
And you can get the paper in that. That pretty much summarizes. The other papers are in different places.
Well, that must have been very exciting for you to find that correlation.
Well, I think it was important because it gave me an insight to the fact that maybe cancer death isn't the only thing we should be looking at.
You mean before cancer becomes a lot of other diseases and symptoms?
Well, that's right. Cancer is an old age disease. And what happens is it occurs at a younger age. And so what I've been looking at is what are the illnesses now that are showing up in the young adults that never did before. And I think that's your clue to what's happening in our environment.
I see. Well, maybe you could fill us in a little bit about what is actually happening to us, because I know we're told by the National Cancer Institute that they're winning the war on cancer, and yet there do seem to be an awful lot of young, very young people, and children, in fact, who are getting cancer, and there's also other diseases, too, which they don't know why they're getting them, immune diseases.
Odd diseases.
Yes.
Autoimmune disease is very much the same mechanism as ionizing radiation effects. And there are other things that I think there's combinations between the chemical exposures and the radiation exposures, so that since World War II, we have very drastically increased the number and the quantity of toxic chemicals in our ordinary environment, and that does damage to the DNA, and it damages in particular the protection which is natural for human beings who live on a planet where there's background radiation. And so the background radiation, which is chronic low dose, is more effective now than it was prior to 1945 or prior to World War II. So some of the problem is coming from that combination of hazards. And unfortunately, very few people study both. When you're in university and you study epidemiology, you specialize either in chemicals or in radiation. And if you have a major study, you have to hire people in both of those fields if you want to look at the joint effect of chemicals and radiation. So there's very few research papers in this area.
Yeah.
But I think it's a very important one.
I was noticing Janet Sherman was writing about an epidemiological study that was done of high breast cancer rate in Long Island, I believe. And I guess that study, which was done by the National Cancer Institute, I think, didn't take into account any radiation at all. It was all about other causes.
No, they said it would be more expensive because they'd have to hire people who were trained in radiation to be on the team, so they left it out. They also said, which shocked me, and this is also true of other breast cancer studies, that they already knew radiation caused breast cancer, so it wasn't necessary to include it, which really kind of blows my mind.
doesn't quite make any logical sense, because if it's a cause, wouldn't you want to figure out where it was coming from?
Yes, and people think if it wasn't studied, then it wasn't important. So it gets lost. And some of that is just the researchers who want to find something new. You know, they know that radiation causes it, so they don't study that.
Now, you were talking about ionizing radiation, and I think perhaps it would be good to define that a bit, because people also, some doctors refer to sunlight as being ionizing radiation, but I think you're talking about nuclear ionizing radiation.
Well, the electromagnetic spectrum, which is everything from radio waves, microwave, visible light, ultraviolet, X-ray, gamma rays, that comes to us from outer space and from the sun, and it's like the natural ambient environment. We do have a protective layer of our planet, the Van Allen belts. They capture the most of the gamma rays, which are particles, cosmic particles, and they protect the Earth from them. And there's also the ozone layer, which stops some of the ultraviolet. So most of the visible rays are not ionizing. Ionizing just means, does this photon stream that's coming in as light, that is it strong enough to knock an electron out of its orbit? Because if it can, it forms two ions, a negative ion, which is the electron, free electron, and then the rest of the atom becomes positively charged and is a positive ion. As soon as you get to the microwave or the radio waves or low frequency, extra low frequency, they don't have enough energy to knock an electron out of orbit. It really has to be given an escape velocity. And they're non-ionizing radiation. Now, they have other problems, so it's not just ionization. Ionization is a big problem because it can break the long molecules, the proteins, the DNA, the RNA, all those things that are so vital for keeping well. And if they break them, then you get particles of these protons, and they can come together in a new way, which kind of messes up your biochemistry. So that ionization is a very important property. But you also have vibrations when you have electromagnetic radiation, and those vibrations can also affect things like circadian rhythm, so your sleep patterns, your breathing patterns, your heartbeat. For example, if you have a pacemaker, you should stay away from the microwave ovens. Things like that, you know, they can disrupt natural rhythms as well as mechanical rhythms. So I'm not saying that anything, you know, that's not ionizing is not harmful.
Yeah.
But it's a different kind of harm.
I see. The study you spoke of in the beginning of the 10-year-long study, or 20-year-long, actually, I think it was, and you said that was for medical radiation. You were studying leukemia.
Yes, incidences? This is the diagnostic x-rays.
Okay.
So-called harmless dental x-rays, chest x-rays, and so on. Now we have, at that time we didn't have CAT scans.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe you can, I must have interrupted you because I wanted to find out a little more about what that study concluded about medical radiation and basically which ones are the worst ones, and whether it's improved since that study was done, and what you think about the current state.
I think the medical schools teach physicians mostly the benefits of X-ray. And so they come out really thinking that the X-ray is harmless. And we have an insurance system where most people who have insurance, their x-rays are covered. And we also have a malpractice problem in the U.S., so it's a financial benefit to the doctor to do a lot of x-rays because he has well-documented background for his diagnosis. So I think everything in our society seems to make people want more x-rays, whether it's wanted by the doctor or it's wanted by the patient. And actually, most are not necessary because they don't change the treatment. So if you're going to have a medical x-ray, you really should say, will it affect the treatment? Is it important to know? in some cases, it's very important. Certainly, if you're going to have a brain surgery, you want them to take a look at what's inside the skull. But there are other x-rays that really add nothing to your usable information in terms of treatment. It is dangerous. If you need it, you have it. Okay. Because there's a benefit.
We're talking to Dr. Rosalie Bertel, who's a Grey Nun of the Sacred Heart and also is a biometrician and environmental epidemiologist. Maybe you could we could run through some of the common radiological scans that people have. How about mammograms, for instance, which people are often recommended to get?
Well, I think the mammogram as a diagnostic tool has some value, but I don't think there's any value to the routine screening with mammograms. Much of the promise of benefit comes from research which is unacceptable. I guess I'll just talk about one, the so-called gold standard that they did in New York State, where they followed a very large number of women. They had the mammography group and no mammography. And then they compared the number of breast cancers. Now, the original raw data showed more cancers in the mammography group than there were in the controls. So they started to look at the actual cases, and they found out that in the mammography group, they had a large number of women who had had previous breast cancer. So these were really recurrence, not original breast cancers. Mm. And then they looked at the controls, and they found that there were only a third as many women in the controls that had had a previous breast cancer. Now, this is after they looked at the data. They took out then all the women that had had cancer previously. And when they did that, then it came out with fewer cancers in the mammography group and more in the group that did not have mammography, and that's what they published. But that's not acceptable, because if you really had a random sample to start with, then there should have been roughly the same number of people in the two groups that had had previously a breast cancer. And it's quite worrisome when three times as many of those who had had breast cancer had a recurrence with the mammography than had it without the mammography. So you've got potentially here a very serious hazard for those who had breast cancer. And that was just discarded data. So they never really went through the whole set to find out whether they had a random sample in the first place. And if they didn't, then the rest of the data is useless.
Hmm.
So it was a very poor basis for their extended program of screening non-symptomatic women. So I've just never had it, and I don't believe that we can actually find any data to prove it's beneficial or data to find it's harmful, because they really have not done a study of the people who've had breast cancer.
Dr. Samuel Epstein, who I interviewed fairly recently, he maintains that it's much more effective to do manual examinations of breast tissue than it is to do it with a... Or maybe he didn't say it was more effective, it was much safer because of the compression damage and also the radiation effects.
Right, but in Canada they did a very large study, and they have nurses who are trained to manually examine breasts.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. And they found out that those specially trained nurses were just as good as the mammogram. So to me, that says, why don't you teach women how to do this? Because they know their own breasts better than anybody else, and they can find abnormalities much more in a much earlier time if they're trained. And so it makes sense to help women to learn how to do it.
So you're saying it's actually more effective because they find it earlier?
Yes, because they know their own breasts. They can get familiar with it.
Mm.
And if they know the techniques and they know what it feels like, you can even get these plastic breasts that have cysts in them and tumors and fibroids. And so you can feel in the plastic, you can feel it and get used to how it feels different. So, you know, this could be done. This, is, to me, is a much better way to get at it.
And do you think the emphasis on the high-tech mammogram is a result of love of technology or the fact that they've just invested in this and they want to pay the cost of actually installing those machines?
Well, it was a pretty big program in the 70s, early 70s. Oh. They actually had quite a large grant, and they were going to set up special mammogram clinics all over the country. And the original proposal that went into the National Cancer Institute, I know I calculated the radiation dose that the women would get, and it would have caused about 12 cancers for every one they picked up early. And so we raised a big fuss over it. Dr. Bros was the head of our department, and so he challenged them on this, and that was never funded by the National Cancer Institute, and it got quiet for a while. And then they very drastically reduced the dose and came up again. But I still don't think they've made an argument for why there's a benefit. No. And I think a lot of women think it's a benefit because it finds an early cancer at very small size and early stage. But it's finding maybe 800, 900 times what was found in the past, and if those obviously would never grow into a full-blown diagnosable cancer.
Oh.
They just never materialize, that the body's immune system destroys them. So there's a lot of over-diagnosis, over-treatment, which it's scary to a woman if you tell her she has a malignant tumor in the breast.
Sure.
And of course she's going to take care of it. But many of those will not ever develop, and we can't tell because they're doing some kind of procedures on all of them.
Hmm. Yeah, that is you're painting a picture there that it's a little bit scary because people go in because they're worried, and of course then they find something. But you're saying most of those things they find would probably just take care of themselves if your immune system is functioning.
Well, clearly a great number of them would be taken care of. So anyway, I just think that women need to be trained to do self-examination, and I think it's ideal what they had in Canada with nurses who were trained, because I think it's more acceptable to women to have nurses do the examination and teach them how to do it.
How closely are Canada and America related in terms of medical treatment? Are they pretty similar?
Well, I don't think there's as much. They don't have the malpractice suits in Canada, so that they're making decisions on a different basis. So that it's very hard to compare the two. But this was a pretty well-accepted study they did in Canada, mm-hmm. and I think that I think that finding has been ignored or overlooked.
I see. And what about Europe? Do they are they scanning as frequently as we are?
It's been hard to get women to go to have the mammograms. I don't think it's been successful anywhere that I know of.
Hmm. So have they been
either they don't go or they're disappointed in the results.
I see.
And then, of course, a lot of the breast cancers numbers decreased because of the study of the estrogen. And so when they stop taking estrogen post-menopausal, then the cancer rates went down. That's another thing.
Yeah, how significant was the estrogen in causing cancer?
Very significant.
Wow.
It's really taken as little as possible now.
I see. Well, I know there's a number of people who are still recommended to take it, you know, for hot flashes and such.
Yeah, if they're really, you know, severe and they need relief, but they shouldn't really be taken more than a year.
Mm.
People were on them for 5 years sometimes.
I think, yeah, my mother was on it for a very long time and eventually had a stroke, which I think might be related to estrogen.
Yeah, heart and cancer both.
Hmm.
I mean, it's too bad, but people make mistakes, and I think a mistake on the order of trying to get every woman to have mammograms, that you're asking for trouble.
Because it's such a nationwide,
so widespread,
yeah.
And it's to asymptomatic women.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have symptoms and you need to use it for diagnostic purposes, that's one thing. And, you know, you do get a benefit from that. But I don't see it for, screening.
Yeah, there's another technique like that, which is bone scans. People are being checked with radiation to see how dense their bones are and whether they're candidates for osteoporosis, and that's hasn't made much sense to me because you'd eat the same bone protective diet no matter what.
Well, I don't think too much of the medicines that they're offering. So when they find that you're osteopenia or osteoporosis, then they give you the Fosamax or Boniva or one of those medicines, and they kind of arrest it where it is, but I don't think that they really improve the bone strength in most women. So, again, that's one where I'm not sure that you change the treatment. That's really what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And you do know as you get older, you certainly need vitamin D, probably in 2,000 units a day, and they never used to give it that high because that helps you to digest and absorb the calcium.
I see.
So, you know, those are known benefits.
Yeah. What any other medical x-rays, like the dental x-rays, they always say that it's safe. You know, we're always reassured when we go to the dentist, and they were reassuring us back in the 1950s, and now I think the dose is way lower than that, and they're still saying it's safe.
Yeah, you don't hit as much of the bone marrow, but the dental x-rays can be significant for hitting the thyroid gland and also for the damage to the carotid arteries. So, you know, you don't want them unnecessarily. Also, for older people, if you have a lot of cavities that have been filled with lead filling, that blocks the x-rays, so they can't see anything on the other side of it. So I'd rather have them do a good job of cleaning and really look for cavities. than to just rely on the x-rays.
Yeah, that makes sense. And what about CAT scans, which is a new treatment?
Well, again, they're a marvel if you really need it, but it's also something that's not a toy, and it gives a significant amount of radiation.
So you think CAT scans could actually cause cancer? It's a very high dose, isn't it?
It is. It's a higher dose than the other diagnostic procedures.
I see.
Sometimes they jump to the best one, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when a lesser technology would work. I think this takes judgment. And unless the physicians are trained to know the harm, I think that they tend to get the best picture. You know, it's human.
Yes. I think if they have the technology at their disposal, it's very tempting to use it. Yeah. So that's medical radiation. And where does nuclear power fit into this? I would think that... I think we were originally told that nuclear power plants were safe and going to be very cheap to run, and certainly didn't expect them to leak any radiological chemicals.
No, I thought they were closed systems and that you only had to worry if there was an accident. So it was shocking to me the first time I went to a hearing for the siting of a nuclear power plant in Barker, New York,
mm-hmm.
on the shore of Lake Ontario. And they were explaining how much radiation they would be releasing into the air and into the water of the lake. And they made the comment, it's just like dental x-rays or chest x-rays, which your doctor gives you, therefore it's not harmful. and what I found out when I was at the hearing is that the proposed plant was going to be next door to the baby food, Gerber's baby food farm, the Cornucopia farm.
Wow.
And I couldn't believe they were going to be releasing radiation into the air and the water next to the baby food farm. Anyway, I guess I waxed eloquent, and the people responded to my talk, and the Niagara legislature voted a moratorium against the power plant the next morning.
Hmm.
So that's how I kind of got in the middle of the anti-nuclear movement.
What year was that, Dr. Bertel?
I think that was maybe 75 or 76.
Okay.
It was very early. Anyway, what really bothered me is who gave them permission to emit this radiation. And so I looked back to the radiation regulations, and I found that they had been, the safety regulations were set in 1950 by the physicists from the Manhattan Project.
Oh.
And they had set them because, well, there were different radiation protection standards in the U.S., Canada, and U.K. So they had three different numbers. And the U.S. started atmospheric testing in 1946. So they found out that the fallout blanketed the whole northern hemisphere, and they didn't really want to be sued by any country for fallout, and so they decided they better agree on a standard. And so they got together for 5 years and set these standards. This is way before they saw any data from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And then in 1950, they went to the International Association of Radiologists and asked if they could join. And they wanted to form the International Commission on Radiological Protection. and they had already decided what was going to be the standard. And so they had they did all this. It's available in a book. There was a meeting in Oxford, England, and they published their papers from that meeting, so you can read all about it. And they had already decided that they were only going to look at cancer death as an endpoint, and that they would permit workers to get 5 rad a year and the general public 0.5 rad. And they set everything. They had the standard man. They had all their calculations in place by 1950. And they didn't have the data from Hiroshima until 1957 was the first analysis. So they had already made all their decisions. And this was really protection for the atmospheric nuclear testing. That's what the commercial nuclear plants were using.
I've heard it said that there is no safe level of ionizing radiation.
No, there isn't. And what they did was they decided that they had to keep making nuclear bombs because someone might retaliate. They had already dropped two. And so they, you know, they got everything in place way before they used any nuclear fission for reactors. And, you know, if you're setting up a peaceful atom program, the engineers are not going to question the, you know, where did you get the regulations? They're just going to say, give me a number and I'll make this work and stay within that safety limit. So they think they're pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, they're very thoughtful, and they built the industry around these numbers that were wrong. And they felt very good about it. They don't question standards. They follow them.
Right. And so what do you think the standard should be for nuclear radiation leakage?
Well, I don't see any standard that's acceptable. And that's because of what I said about the chemical pollutants. We've very much damaged what human beings can tolerate in terms of radiation. So I think we need to avoid anything that's going to be adding to our background exposure.
I see. So you're including nuclear radiation in our background exposure. I thought you were just talking about natural environmental, you know, radon.
No, they're all in it. You know, you can't say, well, if it comes from a nuclear plant, it's not going to hurt me, only if it's in my soil.
Right.
You know, it's all the same thing.
I believe Dr. Sternglass made the point that all these, and others have too, that all these chemicals, these radiological chemicals are that come from nuclear technology are brand new, and they seem even more poisonous than the environmental radiation that you get from, you know, in New England, they say there's a pound of uranium per acre on average. But I think they were making the point that this, these chemicals that nuclear technology makes, the strontium-90s and those types of things, are much more poisonous.
Well, there's a difference in bioavailability. Your uranium is in a rock under the ground, so you really can't breathe it, or it's not going to be in your vegetables or your drinking water unless you mine it and break it up and put it up on the surface. But the emissions from a nuclear plant are very small, and they can get into the whole irrigation system for all of fruits and vegetables. They can get in the drinking water for the farm animals, and, you know, you're really polluting the whole ecosphere.
I see. We have a nuclear power plant in southern Vermont, the Vermont Yankee plant, that's coming up for relicensing this year, and if the Vermont legislature doesn't act and relicense them, they'll have to shut down. And the leukemia studies, I know you've written about some on your website, they related to nuclear power plants. Could you explain those studies?
Well, there's the government did studies around of counties that had nuclear plants, but very often those nuclear plants were on the eastern edge of the county, and the wind went into the next county, not the county it was located in. So they keep coming up with these studies that don't show anything. But when you use the election zoning lists, which aren't quite the same as the county lists, you can get your data based on election units, and you can see that these cancers are real. But it's a very difficult argument to make because the government pours money into the so-called official studies that settle the points. Mm-hmm. But even if they're not a good study.
Well, this is where politics meets science. And
right. We have a lot. You see, there's a lot of politics in anything you do that's nuclear because of the nuclear weapons. So you're already in politics, whether you like it or not.
And could you explain, I mean, these are public health officials who have gotten degrees in public health who are making the decisions of how these studies are put
together. Right, but they think that their job is to keep the regulations, not to question the regulations. And as soon as you question the regulations or challenge them, you're into the military, which sets the regulations. Mm. And it's the same regulations whether you're in the military, the commercial, or the hospitals. They all use the same regulations. So it's very difficult to deal with it, even on a hospital level, without getting into disputes with the military.
And could you explain for people how nuclear technology relates, medical nuclear technology and civilian nuclear technology like power plants, how does that relate to military use?
Well, they all use the same radiation protection standards, right? So if the military sets them, they're used in those same standards are used in hospitals for their X-ray equipment. Now there's no limit on how much radiation can be given to a patient in a hospital, and that was, I think, one of the agreements that the physicists made when they took over the International Association of Radiologists and formed ICRP, because the physicists have been more than 50% of the commission that makes all the decisions ever since 1950. But they don't limit medical X-rays. But they do set limits for the equipment.
I see. So you're saying the medical standards for doses of X-rays are actually set by physicists back in the 50s.
Yes, and they're still used in the U.S. And the international community lowered them in 1990. So, for example, the dose to workers is 5 rad. In the U.S., it's 2 rad in most other countries a year. And the dose to the public is 0.5 rad in the States, and it's 0.1 rad in the rest of the world, most of the rest of the world. Mm. So there are differences in the limits. The U.S. is still using the ones that they set in 1950.
That's kind of incredible. Well, we have about 3 minutes left, and I don't know, Dr. Rosalie Bertel, if you'd like to maybe tell our audience what perhaps they can do if they're concerned about pollutants that you've been fighting against a lot of your life, and radiation in particular. What actions do you think people should take?
I think on the medical X-rays, You just have to question, and don't ask for unnecessary x-rays, and question whether or not it makes a difference in the treatment. I know I have at times signed a paper that I refused the x-ray, and I wouldn't hold the doctor responsible if there was a problem later.
Mm.
You know, I thought maybe that would help, and it does help. But for nuclear power plants, we certainly don't need more of them, and they're not a solution to the climate problem. They're actually a problem for the climate because all of their support industries require petroleum. You can't do mining and milling and fabricating of the fuel rods and all the transportation and the working with the waste and, you know, all that requires oil.
Mm-hmm.
So it's silly.
Yeah.
That's not a solution. But it is a health hazard, and I think that we don't want to go down that road. It's going to take all the money and the lion's share of the money, probably make us more broke than we are. I think the basic solution is to outlaw war, because this little planet can't handle it anymore. The weapons that we've been using and that are being developed are enough to ruin this planet for living on it. And so we need to protect it, and we need to... War is a very resource-consuming sector of society, and we're already consuming about 30% more than the Earth can replenish. So we're stealing from future generations. And I think if we could just stop the war business and solve our problems in courts, then we could have, we'd buy time to clean up the rest of our society.
All right. Well, Dr. Rosalie Bertel, Grey Nun of the Sacred Heart, thank you very much for joining us today on Politics and Science.
Thank you.
If you have any questions for Politics and Science, you can direct them by email to politicsandscience@madriver.com. That's politicsandscience@madriver.com. Politics and Science can be heard weekly on WMRW LP Warren 95.1 FM, airing on Mondays at 5 p.m. And in the Bellows Falls area, can be heard on Wool LP Bellows Falls at 101.1 FM, airing from 3 to 4 p.m. on Sundays and from 9 to 10 a.m. on Mondays. Politics and Science presents the viewpoints of its participants and does not necessarily reflect the viewpoints of any other person or organization.